Accession number 18089, real one.
This is an interview with Air Vice Marshal Eric Macy, recorded by Rodney Giesler at Homington near Salisbury on the 25th of November 1998 for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Start off by asking you when you were born.
I was born on the 9th of April 1936 in a little village about 14 miles west of where I'm currently living, village of Tisbury, which is about 14 miles to the west of Salisbury. Born in a fairly humble home. My father was a baker and my mother was what was then termed housewife.
Still a very noble occupation.
Yes, indeed.
So you mentioned that you didn't go straight into the RAF.
No, I was at the local school in Tisbury, took my 11 plus, or whatever it might have been called in those days, 1947, and secured a place at the grammar school at Shaftesbury, just over the border in Dorset. And so travelled daily as a day boy to Shaftesbury Grammar School. Whilst there, in addition to pursuing the normal academic course, I joined the Army Cadet Force, and that was reformed in the course of my stay there and became part of the Combined Cadet Force, but still in the Army section. I rose to the dizzy rank of Lance Corporal. I played the big drum in the corps band. I even lost my stripe as corporal through misbehaviour at summer camp one year. I had my stripe ignominiously torn off my arm, but I did win it back. So that was the extent of my education. I left one year into the sixth form simply because I think my folks were finding it somewhat difficult to keep me on at school. My headmaster was very supportive, and he secured an interview for me with the manager of Lloyd's Bank at Shaftesbury. Mathematics was my forte, I suppose, at school. And the bank manager, we're now in, 1953-ish, had me in and said, yes, you measure up jolly well, but I suppose national service beckons. And I said, well, yes, that's absolutely right. He said, well, quite frankly, I don't want to invest in training you for a bank career. You then go off and join the Queen's services, and then fail to come back. That money will be wasted. They'll come back when you've finished your national service. Well, I then had a bit of a void of at least a year before, of course, being old enough for national service. So I secured an appointment at Boscombe Down as a flight test observer. I was engaged principally on helicopter and towed target research.
So the civilian job?
Yes, I was then part of the Ministry of Supply organisation. And I had the dizzy title of an assistant scientific officer. Again, I was just, I suppose, 17 and a few months when I went to work there. My flight observer duties required me to fly on the then very early Sycamore helicopters, Dragonfly, S-55, Hiller, the Bristol 175, which when developed became the 192, the Belvedere, and the little Saunders Row Skeeter.
Is this on the basis of your mathematics?
Essentially so,
yeah.
Because I would fly on a particular trial, whether it was pitot-head calibration for measuring airspeed or whatever, or carbon monoxide concentrations in the cockpit with various combinations of door open, windows shut, and so forth, and then come back and analyse the data. And contributed to the production of a report. And at that stage, and I was working there for some 15 months, I really had no aim to pursue a career within aviation. This was very much a stopgap.
You weren't aeroplane struck?
I wasn't. No, I never was. I never had any boyhood ambition to be anything in particular. But no doubt about it, my interest in aviation was whetted because at that time, the UK was developing a vast range of aircraft, all of which were appearing on the ramp at Boscombe Down, and I was watching all this happen, including, of course, all the early V-bombers, of which perhaps more later on. I was destined, in fact, at that stage, to join the Army, in particular the Royal Army Educational Corps. There was a mercenary aspect to this. I was going to teach mathematics in the Army, and the humblest rank in the Army Educational Corps was sergeant, to give the authority, I suppose, to the required instructional task. And, of course, that paid rather more than the £4 a day on offer to a private. However, things didn't work out that way because I shared an office with a colleague whose name perhaps I ought not to mention, and he was very, very keen to be a Royal Air Force aviator. And so he went off to Hornchurch, which was then the Officer and Aircrew Selection Centre. And after the whatever it was, 3 days or so, he came back with his tail very much between his legs. He had been rejected. And I vividly recall him saying, "Well, if I can't pass, nobody can pass." Well, I have to say that was a red rag to this agricultural bull. So a little while later, I went down the same route, and they called my bluff. They offered me the opportunity to train as a pilot. And that began my career with the Royal Air Force. Initially, yes, I joined as National Service, but within days I was persuaded, presumably gained financial inducement because the National Service day rate was £4 a day to the MF, for National Servicemen, 7 shillings a day for regulars. And so I then agreed to become a regular, serve the additional year, 3 years. And so that was, yes, that was the basis of my officer training on a short service commission.
Of course, it was very expensive to train pilots for National Service in those days because they only had about 6 months.
Exactly that.
Out of them in the end.
Yes. In fact, the majority of the people leaping ahead now to flying training were National Service men who, as you rightly say, at the end of their 2 year stint, many of whom had never flown on squadrons because there wouldn't have been time to compete in OCU, went straight back into further education or commerce or whatever. And many of them I'm still in contact with today. But I think only 3 or 4 of us, in fact, completed a full, what I might call a full career. Yes, it wasn't an expensive option for them. Mm.
So you signed on and became a regular?
Yes.
What, for 5 years, 7 years?
No, initially three as a regular airman, and then there was a commissioning arrangement called DCA or DCB. And let me get the date. I think I joined initially for 8 years with the option of serving a further 4. That which was non-pensionable, but with a gratuity at the end. And, of course, in the course of those first 8 years, I applied for and secured a permanent commission. And that, of course, led on to the option to serve until the age of 38, or with a further option to continue. And I, in fact, served right through to my 55th birthday.
Mm. Now, what was the training route in those days? What was your ab initio trainer?
Having moved away from the initial training school, which was Curtin Lindsay, Curtin Lindsay's in Lincolnshire, uh-huh. Quite close to Gainsborough. The course, the pilot element of the course, was split two ways. Half went across to America for training, and the remainder were trained in the UK, where there were three basic flying training schools then in existence. South Cerny, I think, Feltwell and Halavington, and it was to Halavington that I reported on the 23rd of February 1955, and of course on that day my commission became effective as an acting pilot officer. And so to Halavington in February 55 to do basic flying training on the Piston Provost, and that was essentially a 9-month course, 135 flying hours. I was not a natural student. There's no doubt about that, Of the 16 who started training, I was the 15th to go solo, and I came very close to being suspended. But nonetheless, I had one last chance, and well, somebody had some confidence in me, and I continued the course.
How long did it take you to go solo?
I was some 15 and a half hours, whereas the earlier solos were perhaps after 9 or 10. Perhaps they had been University Air Squadron people, or not, I can't remember the details. But I know I was very, very close to
what
being...
What was the blockage? I mean, couldn't you get your landings right, or what was it?
I don't know. I can't remember precisely what it was. I don't think I responded terribly well to an instruction. Perhaps I lacked self-confidence. I know my navigational ability in the air was not good in those early days. In fact, I failed my initial navigation final handling test, and that was towards the end of the course. So I think I just didn't... I wasn't a natural pilot. I had to work jolly hard at all of the exercises to bring it together. And, well, there we are.
Anyhow, you got your wings, didn't
you? One didn't. That was completion of the basic flying training. And those of us who completed the course moved on to Middleton St. George, which is near Darlington in Yorkshire, which is now the location of Teesside Airport. And we reported there in the November of 1955, and things seemed to go much better there. Wings came at the end of that course, but we relocated to Worksop before the conclusion of the course. So I think it was something like 6 to 9 months at Middleton, and then moved down the road to Worksop in Nottinghamshire, where, again, I survived together with most of my colleagues. But this time I flew off with a close colleague, who is still a very close friend, for the aerobatic trophy. He won. He came first in the rating, and I came second. So it was quite strange. I made much better progress on the jet phase, flying then the Vampire T-11 for the dual exercises, and the fighter bomber version, the Mark 5 or the Mark 9, for the solo exercises.
Quite a big
It was, yes, it was. But nonetheless, I seemed to respond much better at that stage. Perhaps my growing confidence and perhaps even a more sympathetic instructor helped.
Yeah.
I should say that that course, it was number 108 course, which graduated from Worksop in the July of 1956, has formed a very strong association. We have an annual reunion. We had our 42nd annual reunion this year. We have lost only one in a fatal flying accident, and we're a very close bunch of chaps still, which is very rewarding. From Worksop, after a short break, together with three others, in fact, I think they creamed off, if that's the right phrase, the top four of the course, we were given the opportunity to convert onto fighters. And the Hunter was then just entering recently entered the infantry. Two of us went to Pembrey in South Wales for the Hunter conversion unit. Two others went to Chibnall, where they also did their Hunter conversion. Ironically, the two who went to Chibnall were posted onto Venom squadrons in Germany, and they never did capitalise on that Hunter training. But in fact, I did move into the Hunter world. I joined number 263 squadron, flying the then very recently introduced Hunter Mark 6, a very potent aircraft in the day.
As an interceptor?
As an interceptor, yes, primarily as a high-level day interceptor. It had a limiting indicated airspeed of 620 knots, which was jolly fast, quite intimidating for a young chap with little or no experience. It was, of course, transonic in a dive, an exercise which we practiced. I joined 263 at Wymsweald in Leicestershire, where the squadron had temporarily been located whilst the runway of its main operating base at Wattisham was being resurfaced. So after a short spell at Wymsweald, we moved back to Wattisham, where I was with the squadron for 18 months or so. Towards the end of that tour, the squadron relocated to Stradishaw. And it was whilst at Stradishaw, the squadron, the same element, that is the same personnel, the same aircraft, renumbered overnight we dropped our nameplate, number 263, and picked up number 1 squadron nameplate, simply because number 1 had then been operating, or had been operating at Tangmere, with Hunter 2s and 5s, with the very suspect Sapphire engine. Of course, it wasn't done for one squadron to disband, so 263 effectively disbanded and reformed the following day as number 1. Now, 1958, we're in now, towards the end of 1958, and Duncan Sands, of course, wielded his famous axe. A number of squadrons were to be disbanded, or were to be diminished in size. I think we had 23 pilots on the squadron and 16 aircraft. We were required to reduce to 16 pilots and 12 aircraft. And it was a question of first in, first out. And I was approaching the end of my tour. I was also the adjutant to the then CO, one squadron leader, Les de Garris, with whom I'm still in contact. And the openings for those to be thrown on the scrap heap, as it seemed to us at the time, were fighter controller, a ground appointment, of course, a temporary ground job whilst waiting for the transport force to build up when co-pilots would be required, or immediate co-pilot in the then rapidly expanding V-Force. And I was keen to continue flying, I suppose, on anything. So not really knowing what I was venturing into, I volunteered for the V-Force. And that really started a whole new chapter of my flying career.
I'd like to ask you, you know, in detail about that chapter, but before we leave the existing stage in your story, particularly your arrival on an operational Hunter squadron, can you tell me a bit more detail about operating Hunters? I mean, what was it, A, like as an aeroplane to fly, and what were you trained to do, and how did you do it?
My recollection, recollections of that era, to some extent, have been overshadowed by all the things that followed later. But I do recall joining the squadron as the most junior pilot, of course, the 23rd, when, to be a wee bit frivolous, one's immediate appointment was to run the coffee bar. The chap who had immediately joined preceded me. Of course, he was very happy to see somebody else come along and take over the coffee bar. You were split. The squadron was headed by a squadron leader, split into two flights, and with 11 on each flight, the flight commander plus 10. And it was a question then of building on the training, the very limited training given at the operational conversion unit. Close formation flying was continued. Battle formation flying was introduced. We did very little of that, as I recall, at the OCU. Initially in pairs, and then as a pair being the basic element of the fighter force, and then as a unit of four.
That's battle formation.
Battle formation, which introduced, of course, all the crossover turns and all those very exciting manoeuvres that we were required to do. The aim of battle formation being to ensure that everybody within the formation could be seen by the other members of the formation to give cover and warning of any attack on the formation. And then, of course, to respond to whatever command had been given to manoeuvre, to intercept, to survive, or whatever. So the basic unit was a pair, and most of my flying in the first few months were as wingman.
That's the one on the end.
That's right, yeah, on the outside, flying outside, yeah. Essentially in echelon to the pairs.
Out into the rear.
Leader, out and stepped back and to the rear, perhaps 200 or 300 yards back and 75 yards laterally displaced. And, of course, the side, whether you're echelon, port or starboard, depended on the manoeuvres that were thrown by the formation leader. He didn't call these formation turns at all. You just had to respond instinctively and change your position relative to the leader as appropriate. We were introduced then to weapons training, initially through the medium of the dear old cine camera. There's a gun sight mounted on the top of the combing, where one could, by using the twist grip control on the throttle, track the hostile aircraft or the simulated hostile aircraft and assess its range, because its wingspan was required to fit inside the six diamond reticule that was projected up there. And so one would initially be required to follow the simulated hostile aircraft, whose own maneuvers will become ever more violent, and you are required to hold the pipper on, and eventually, of course, close in to what was would have been the firing range. The weapons on the Hunter at that stage were four Aden 30mm guns, a very potent weapon indeed, which, when you fired all four, caused a considerable loss of airspeed through the reaction. So that was how one was...
How long did it take to empty your... I mean, if you got stuck on the button, how long would it take to empty the magazine?
Oh, a matter of literally a few seconds.
Really?
A few seconds, yes. I think we carried something like 100 rounds in each gun. And they literally go in seconds. And we lost several knots of airspeed, 10, 20 knots or more, perhaps. I can't remember.
And another Hunter would act as your target?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Initially, on squadron training, yeah. Yes. So then, having satisfied the boss that one could track and range and hold the pipper on and get good film, then one progressed from the simulated weapon training to actual weapon training. At that time, the target, the aerial target, was a banner, a large bit of material which was towed behind a meteor on a very long line. The meteor would fly at some 170 knots over the sea ranges. Lowest off was one, I remember. And so the meteor would take off with it towing its banner target. We would rendezvous with it on the range, and then commence a series of quarter attacks, usually high-level quarter attacks coming in from one side or another, coming on to the target, again holding the pipper on for the requisite amount of time until coming into the firing envelope, and then firing. Again, this before live firing was authorised, one would have to satisfy the boss, you could do this with Cine. Because, of course, safety was of paramount importance here. To digress for a moment, if one cut the firing angle too finely, such that the towing aircraft, the meteor, appeared in the frame, I think there's a substantial fine for every frame in which the meteor appeared. Now, I do recall I was not a very clever fighter pilot. I was not terribly good at holding the pipper on the target, whether it was the aircraft or the flag for that matter, and I do know that my gunnery scores were not impressive. However, that was another aspect of training. A further aspect, of course, when you could pull all this together, was combat training. Initially one-on-one, when the aircraft you were exercising with would manoeuvre violently, and you were required to follow it. An exercise which normally began as what was called a tail chase, until the point when you got into firing range and took your hopefully convincing cine film to demonstrate that you had indeed done just that. One-on-one initially, then 2v2, so the basic element of a pair would combat with another element of a pair. These were initially done in a visual mode. The aircraft would take off perhaps as a formation of four, split and come together. But of course, we also were controlled by the GCI, the Ground Control Interception Radar Service. We also practiced another method of interception called broadcast control, where the people on the ground, perhaps working with degraded radar, would issue a broadcast using map references of where they thought the target formation was, and you had to work out your own interception using this GRF, this geographic reference system. So there we are. I think that really was about it.
In techniques, apart from the performance of the aircraft, it was very much Battle of Britain.
Essentially so. Wasn't it? Essentially so.
I mean, against, yes, for high-altitude manned bombers.
Yes. That's exactly right. And just occasionally we had the opportunity to practice that, because we would get engaged, we would engage in an exercise when real bombers could be seen in the air. The bomber of the day would be the Canberra, principally. We did engage in exercises based in Ireland. I remember going to Aldergrove, because the Americans were very much a force in the country at the time, and they, their movements across the Atlantic were used to advantage. The B-47 was one such. We used to intercept the B-47s coming across the Atlantic from this detachment base in Aldergrove. And that's the first time I think most of us would ever have seen a large aircraft in our sights. And I have to say, it was quite intimidating to force oneself to get in close. It looked so large and so close in comparison with what one had been looking at, a 34-foot wingspan Hunter. That was a standing...
You could outfly a B-47.
Oh, very much so. Mm. Yes, very much so. Mm. Yes. The Hunter was, in fact, a very potent aircraft. Its manoeuvrability in my hands was initially limited, because it used to tuck in and flick earlier on. But it then experienced two modifications, one to its leading edge, where a modification called the sawtooth leading edge was introduced, which delayed the pitch up, and also the further modification was to the tailplane structure, where the follow-up all-moving tail was introduced, which gave one much better control. And by the time I left the squadron, I think virtually all of the aircraft had both the sawtooth leading edge and the follow-up tail. Yeah. And even I didn't lose control quite so frequently in those days.
What was the rate of climb like? I mean, presumably you had a scramble and a... I mean, you
yes.
didn't fly standing patrols. You haven't got the endurance for that, had you?
No, we didn't. No. I should say, we did mount what was called, and I shall refer to this later on perhaps, when talking about my V-Force days, we mounted a reaction alert, quick reaction alert, whereby a pair of aircraft would indeed be sat on the end of a runway at readiness to scramble to intercept whatever the ground control interception or the defence controllers thought was worthy of being looked at. We occasionally did this from our own home base, but I do recall that Horsham St Faith was the base for the QRA force. I don't suppose it matters now if I mention the word. The exercise was called Fabulous, and if the squadron was tasked on exercise Fabulous, it detached lock, stock and barrel to Horsham for the period in which it was required to cover this exercise. And that was its dedicated role for a period of time, in daylight. Initially, the Meteor Night Fighter Force took over at dusk and carried through till dawn. The Javelin was introduced in the same time frame, and the Javelin steadily replaced the Meteor Night Fighter. But we continued in that mode right the way through my tour. Exercise Fabulous was renamed to Exercise Halyard, I remember, in my tour of duty.
What enemy types would you have been intercepting at that stage?
I think, if my memory serves me correctly, it would have been the Bear, the Tupolev Bear, the turboprop aircraft principally. The Bison was perhaps in the infantry then.
Backfire and
blind eye. No, they hadn't. No, no. There was another twin-engine version. Which I'm sad to say I can't remember. We did do aircraft recognition of all the aircraft types that we might find in the sky at that time. We had a very enlightened squadron commander. I mentioned his name just now, Les de Garris, who set great store by the rapport between aircrew and ground crew. I mentioned there were only 23 pilots. The ground crew, I suppose, was no more than about 50 strong, headed up by, I recall at one stage, a warrant officer, another stage, a flight sergeant. And what he would do, we would meet for morning briefing, the Met briefing, ostensibly, which perhaps lasted 5 minutes. We would then have 5 minutes or so of aircraft recognition, using the old epidioscope. And then, finally, he would have a few minutes of airman recognition. He had a rogues gallery on his office wall with little photographs, like passport photographs, of all of the ground crew tucked in there. He would pick out at random most mornings a few of these, throw them on the epidioscope, and say, right, who's that? And if you didn't know who that airman was, woe betide you. Jolly good way.
Very good.
Yes, it was. And I had a lot
by
of...
By name and function.
Very much so. Mm. Yes. Mm. Mm. You asked just now, and I didn't answer that question, about the rate of climb. I'm scratching into my memory bank. I feel that the time to 40,000 feet, which was a notional interception level, was 8.5 minutes in the Hunter 6. We were fitted with underwing tanks during the course of my tour. Initially, we had just internal fuel, which didn't last for more than about 35, 40 minutes. Fitting the underwing tanks, initially each of 100, two of 100 gallons, pushed up towards 50 minutes, 55. We had one major overseas detachment in my time, that was to Cyprus, where we fitted two larger tanks, two 30-gallon tanks.
Ferry.
That's right, yes. Mm.